The Hard Shoulder on News Talk
with Nissan. Let's go the distance by keeping our distance. Nissan, innovation that excites.
All right, well, on a Friday, we like to round off the week by taking a review of the non-COVID stories, particularly outside of Ireland. And our journalist and broadcaster friend, Barbara Feeney, well known to colleagues as Babs, I don't know why, is joining us because she picks up the collections. Let's start with this. Well, that isn't a concerto. That is, in fact, the Chinese national anthem. I didn't know that. Why are we playing it, Babs?
Well, Ivan, I wasn't too familiar with the Chinese national anthem either. So we're hearing the anthem because it's part of the reason for a scuffle that broke out in Hong Kong's parliament on Monday. So it all stemmed from a row about the Chinese national anthem bill, which, if introduced, would criminalise disrespect of the anthem. So Hong Kong don't actually have their own anthem. So when they play a national football match, the Chinese anthem is played and it's often booed. And obviously the Chinese don't like us. So the argument started between legislators because they were trying to appoint someone to oversee this committee who would be responsible for this bill. So the pro-democracy lawmakers didn't like what was happening because a pro-Beijing person was responsible for putting that person in place. So they entered the chamber on Monday and they tried to reach the leader in his seat, kind of charged at him. But he was surrounded by 20 security guards. And then at one point, a lawmaker took a running jump to try and reach him. It was chaos. There's footage online. It's actually incredible to watch. They're all in their face masks, charging at each other. Apparently, there was someone on the ground. There was guards pulling them out. Someone was injured. Anyway, so the chaotic scenes, they were happening for a couple of minutes. They removed people. And then obviously afterwards, they then went and elected a pro-Beijing chairwoman of this committee. So it looks like, you know, this national anthem bill could be passed.
Indeed. So just put us in, because we would have been aware of the tear gas, the kind of ratcheting up of the violent scenes right across Hong Kong over about an 18-month period. But it's been off our screens, maybe for COVID reasons, I don't know, of recent times. So all of the row in terms of kind of elbow room for Hong Kong people to have their independence, not to be a satellite of China. Is that bubbling up again? And is it coming to maybe China biting back?
It really is, Ivan. So these chaotic scenes during the week in the Hong Kong Parliament are just further evidence of the deep division in Hong Kong. So Hong Kong is obviously a special administrative region of China. So China are continuing to try and tighten their grip on Hong Kong. And it looks like these demonstrations will start again. And they're now even more likely because news today, China has proposed that they're going to try and impose new national security laws on Hong Kong. So these laws would bar subversion, separatism, or acts of foreign interference against the central government. So these efforts by China's Communist Party to impose a national security law, they've been widely interpreted as a move to take full control over the territory. So in effect, like, some of the news outlets are saying goodbye Hong Kong if these laws came in. And obviously there's been a lot of international criticism and it looks like further unrest will reignite.
Yeah, because it strikes me that, you know, if you're heading for a Chinese clampdown in Hong Kong, sort of a la Tiananmen Square before, that really will not work because A, Hong Kong is the gateway between East and West for investment. And that would frighten off investors because the one thing they like is stability. And the second thing is, if you actually look at the young people and the students and all, they're pretty resilient.
Oh, completely.
I don't see them wearing this, you know. Like, it seems to me it's going to get worse. All right, now, you have another story. I think it's from Asia. It's an incredible story of an abduction with a happy ending. Let's take a listen to this.
When you came to find me, I couldn't believe it. When they did the DNA test, I was still in shock.
What's the story, Barbara?
So that is the voice of 34-year-old Mao Yin. So he was reunited with his parents earlier this week after 32 years. So the story is he was abducted from a hotel in the city of Xi'an in 1988. So he was a small little boy on his way home from nursery. He told his father that he was thirsty. So they stopped in a hotel where his father went to get some water. And when he turned around, he was gone. So his parents have spent the years since then searching for him. His mother handed out 100,000 flyers. His mother even quit her job to search for him. She appeared in a number of Chinese TV shows like X Factor, appealing for information. They got leads, but nothing came of them. Then in 2007, she actually started volunteering with a group called Baby Come Back Home, because this is a phenomenon in China, to help other parents. She helped 29 other children be reunited with their families. And then obviously, finally, she was reunited with her son. So anyway, the family were reunited at a police news conference on Monday that was broadcast live on Chinese TV. And it was, you can go and watch it online. It's on various news websites on YouTube. And it was really emotional. The young man opened the doors and saw his parents for the first time in 32 years. And they were embracing and hugging and crying. It's a really lovely story.
So, I mean, like, I understand, you know, my kids wanted to leave home at 12 or 14, but at 2 years of age, it's not an independent choice. What was the backstory? He was abducted, was he?
Yeah. So he was taken. Apparently, this is quite common in China. I think childless parents often buy, like, I don't know how often it happens, but they buy children, like, illegally. It's horrible, but it happens. But what was incredible
is
that...
Well, let's be fair, they eat bats and dogs. I mean, like,
Ivan, let's be fair. But wait till you hear what they did. The fact that they were able to track this young man down in China, and think of how many people live in China. So they used a facial recognition technology. So basically, they took the photo from when he was a toddler and then sort of retrofitted that to see what he would look like now. And then they had that in a national database. And then they got a tip-off in April about a man who lived in the Sichuan province. So that's about 1,000 kilometers from Xi'an, where he was abducted. The police went to where they heard about this man. They did a DNA test, came back positive. And then they then discovered that this couple had actually bought this boy for the equivalent of 750 euro. And he now runs a home decoration business. And obviously he was, I'm sure, shocked to discover that he had been abducted, but incredible.
Well, what a story. I mean, like, if they'd rung me, I would have given away any of mine for free. But the point is this, that if you take the story, did, like, because it was 32 years, did you develop, you know, the way adoptive parents become your real parents, and, you know, people sometimes are much more attached to them. And what's that syndrome, Stockholm syndrome or whatever. So, I mean, like, what was his attitude to his abductors?
We don't know much about his parents who bought him, but he must have had a fairly happy life. He's running a business. He was very happy to see his real parents.
Right.
But I'm sure maybe there'll be criminal proceedings against
indeed
these people.
Whoever organized it. So is this common in China?
Yeah, so they don't have official figures, but in 2015, it was estimated that 20,000 children were being abducted each year in the country. And in 2009, China's Ministry of Public Security set up a DNA database, which helped find more than 6,000 missing children. And then they also set up something called Reunion. And by June 2019, that led to more than 4,000 children finding their families. Incredible.
Well, it is. It's a happy ending, as you say. It's a great outcome, and that is fantastic. Right. Now, as regular listeners, the Hard Shoulder will know that I am an expert on all matters international. But I do admit that East Africa is a little source of weakness. I get mixed up with different countries, and I haven't a clue where Burundi is.
Ivan, I'm surprised that you're not familiar with East African politics. It is a small country in East Africa. It's bordered by Rwanda, Tanzania and the DRC. So they...
What's the DRC? Forgive me.
The Democratic Republic of Congo.
Congo. All right. Like, was that like the Belgian Congo back in the day in the United Nations and all that? I digress.
I believe so.
So basically, what's the problem in Burundi?
They, of all things, this week held a presidential election, which is quite unusual to hear at the times we're living in right now. So this election is meant to usher in the first democratic transition in 58 years of independence. So Wednesday, people went queued up to replace their long-serving president. His name is Pierre Nkurunziza, and his government. Listen, don't make me pronounce that again. I've done lots of practice.
Oh, Pierre, anyway, Pierre.
So his government have obviously, they've been accused of all sorts of human rights abuses. And when he ran for his third term in 2015, he was condemned by the opposition as unconstitutional. That sparked mass unrest. There was then a failed military coup and a crackdown by security forces, which led to hundreds of thousands of people fleeing Burundi and going to neighboring countries. So there's been huge violence. And then the build-up to this election has been marred by violence. The BBC put together actually an explainer about the election. And here they talk about some of that violence.
Human rights organizations say the government has used its might to intimidate and repress the opposition and its supporters. According to Human Rights Watch, there have been at least 67 documented killings, including 14 extrajudicial executions in the last 6 months. There have also been disappearances, cases of torture, and over 200 arrests against real or perceived political opponents.
Okay, so we kind of get it that this Pierre chappie is a bit of a bad egg. Has the election actually taken place? Who's going to win?
Well, we're still waiting to hear. So, seven candidates contesting the presidency. There are two favourites. There's the candidate who is from the governing party. His name is, now forgive my pronunciation, Evariste Ndayishimiye. And then there's the main opposition leader, Agathon Rwasa. Rwasa actually said at his final rally at the weekend, he warned his followers about possible electoral fraud. The government has also refused any election observers from the UN or the African Union. So it's all very fishy. There was widespread international criticism of Burundi's last election. We're now waiting for results. And the latest is that I read this morning, the head of the country's election commission has appealed for patience as ballots are collected and tallied. So we'll have to wait and see. Mm.
There is an issue in Africa of corruption and the perception of it in different democracies there. We'd be familiar with Zimbabwe and all of that, Mugabe. All right, now, we saw videos of a roof being ripped off on a high-story building. I assume that is the cyclone in India and Bangladesh that we're talking about now.
Yes, Ivan, this is horrendous. It's called Cyclone Amphan. It's caused huge destruction in parts of India and Bangladesh. So nearly 100 people have already been killed. So it made landfall on Wednesday and it kind of moved its way from Bangladesh into India and then hit Calcutta, which is a huge Indian city. And like when you say huge in Indian terms, you mean huge. So thousands of trees were uprooted, electricity, houses were flattened. 14 million people were left without power in Calcutta. Most of the people who died were hit by falling debris. So it's actually one of the worst. It's the first super cyclone to hit the Bay of Bengal since 1999. But what's really sad is that one of the areas affected is called the Sundarbans. So it's an area of about 10,000 square kilometres of mangroves and swampy islands that spans both India and Bangladesh. But it's home to more than 4 million of the world's poorest people. So like the destruction, you know, it's still unclear because they're trying to get in there and see what's happening. And obviously it's been made more difficult with current restrictions, but we'll just have to wait and see.
All right. We're going to round off our international set of stories, Barbara, with an Italian woman who's won an extraordinary raffle prize.
This is a lovely story. So one of Pablo Picasso's paintings named Nature Morte, I'm probably pronouncing that wrong and you can go at me. But anyway, it's a lovely painting.
Well, after last week's lasso, we're still getting over that one.
It's worth an estimated 1 million euro. And it was won in raffle by an Italian accountant named Claudia Borgogno. So it's a small still life painted in 1921 and it shows a newspaper and a glass of absinthe on a wooden table. So the 100 euro raffle ticket was bought for her for Christmas by her son. She was interviewed after winning it. She said she'd never won anything before and she liked Picasso and the prospect of being able to hang one of his paintings on her wall was still sinking in. So her son Lorenzo Nasso, he bought the tickets in December, sent one to his mother and he said maybe it was one of the best decisions he'd ever made in his life. So he actually didn't realise that the rescheduled draw was happening during the week. So he wasn't watching the live broadcast and then he got a call from organisers to tell him and he couldn't believe it. So it was picked out at an electronic draw at Christie's auction house in Paris. It was one of over 50,000 tickets that were sold online. So it was a charity draw. So it's an amazing story.
Absolutely. And they were sold for 100 euros each. Yeah. Is that what you're saying? Right. See, by my maths, that raises 5 million for a 1 million euro painting. Ching, ching. So tell me this. How did it come about? Because it was actually philanthropic. Someone donated it as a prize.
Well, I think that they actually paid for it. So basically, it was a billionaire art collector called David Namad. So he provided the prize. But what they're saying is that he'll be paid 900,000 euro for the work. So, but he actually said that they said the estimated value of the painting is 1 million euro, but he says it's actually worth two or three times that amount. But he does have a collection of 300 works by Picasso. So I don't think he's sure.
I don't know. I'd rather have the cash than, you know, they give you an option. Would you like the cash instead? Certainly, I tell you. All right. My thanks indeed. Fantastic assortment, licorice, all sorts of stories, non-COVID variety across the world, a huge amount of delving and sampling and so on. Barbara Feeney, as always, thank you. We look forward to talking to you again next week. And that's
The Hard Shoulder on Newstalk
with Nissan. Together, let's play our part by staying apart. Nissan, innovation that excites.